From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Eric Westervelt. This is On Point. Cars and gold, steel and pistachios. Yesterday, President Trump smashed back down the hammer of financial sanctions on Iran. A waste of paper, he called Obama's nuclear accord with the country. Many European allies disagree. Iran's economy is in trouble, and this year demonstrations have broken out in parts of the country against a range of grievances. There are some calls in the U.S. for regime change. Is this the start of yet another U.S. military intervention? Have we learned anything from the disastrous Iraq intervention? This hour, On Point, Iran. What's next? You can join us on air and online. What do you make of pulling out of the nuclear deal with Iran and bringing back economic sanctions? Smart move? Dangerous? What's the way ahead? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me now via Skype from Iran's capital, Tehran, is Thomas Erdbrink, the Tehran bureau chief for The New York Times. He's one of the few Western journalists living full-time in the country. His story on Sunday was headlined, "Protests Pop Up Across Iran, Fueled by Daily Dissatisfaction." You can link to it at our website, onpointradio.org. His PBS Frontline documentary about life inside Iran and ordinary Iranians is called Our Man in Tehran. That will air in two parts, August 13th and 14th. And Thomas, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Eric.
Let's go right to this. What's been the reaction on the ground from the Tehran leadership to the reimposition of sanctions now that they have, in fact, taken effect?
Well, the reaction on the ground from the Tehran leadership is in many ways pretty predictable. The people who rule this country have been in power for the past 40 years since the Islamic Revolution, and they have held on to the same worldviews for the past 40 years. And those worldviews are anti-American, anti-any U.S. president, basically. Now, of course, anti-Trump, and naturally, anti-sanctions. So what they have been doing, Iran's leaders, they have been preparing in the last months by, in order to sort of bear the brunt of these coming sanctions by hoarding money for an exchange, which they need to buy goods from abroad. They have managed to buy planes just before the sanctions kicked in yesterday. They got five planes from an Italian-French manufacturer. And they have, of course, been telling their people, be ready, these sanctions are coming, we all need to be united. But at the same time, if you ask average Iranians, they feel sort of differently, if you will. They are tired of living under the same rules for the past 40 years. They are not overly anti-American. Of course, they are very disappointed that the American government keeps on slapping them with sanctions. But at the same time, all they desire is for Iran to be a more normal country. And these people are bearing the brunt of these sanctions. For them, the prices are rising. There's been a massive devaluation of the Iranian rial, the local currency, to the dollar. Iranians have lost 80% of their purchasing power in the last 12 months, something that has accelerated when President Trump unilaterally withdrew America from the five-nation nuclear agreement. So ordinary Iranians are feeling the brunt of these sanctions, and they feel very much under pressure.
Thomas Erdbrink of the New York Times, let's dive into that a little deeper. I mean, Iran's economy is in serious trouble. The currency, as you note, has lost nearly 80% of its value compared to a year ago. I mean, that's incredible, 80%. Foreign investors are fleeing, you know, ahead of the sanctions and their wider impact. How much do you think the economic troubles have to do with the Trump administration's withdrawal from the nuclear agreement in May and restoration of sanctions? And how much of it is really gross mismanagement by Iran's leaders?
Well, as I just said, Iran's leaders have been in power for 40 years and they don't like change. So their approach to the economy is very much outdated, based on some kind of Islamic liberalist slash capitalist mix of economic policies that over the years have really not allowed the Iranian economy to grow. At the same time, there's been massive corruption. People here, they hear that the son of this Ayatollah has been involved in this business case and has stolen this much money. Then the manager of this and this government institution has fled the country, taking, you know, this and this many million dollars with him. So corruption cases, have also undermined people's trust in the economy. But then, of course, there have also been the sanctions. There's been a massive sanction period from 2009 all the way up to 2015. Those sanctions, in a way, brought the Iranians to the negotiating table at the time. Of course, the negotiating table wasn't just between America and Iran, but also Europe and China and Russia were sitting on that table. And out of that, the nuclear deal was born. Now, these sanctions are being reimposed. And that makes life very difficult, because what has basically happened is that foreign banks need to fund projects here in Iran, projects that will bring money, projects that will bring jobs. And foreign banks have been forced by the United States, actually already during the Obama administration, for not to provide credit to Iranian bank institutions. Now, this has had a major impact, because when you can't start any big projects, you can't give people jobs. And now, as a long result of this, plus the mismanagement and the corruption, we are seeing protest here in the country, which is something that is worrying the Iranian leaders, of course.
Let's talk about those protests and much more. I want to hear from the president, though. In May, President Trump pulled out of this 2015 Obama nuclear agreement negotiated by Barack Obama's administration. Here's President Trump in a live address to the nation in May.
The Iran deal is defective at its core. If we do nothing, we know exactly what will happen. In just a short period of time, the world's leading state sponsor of terror will be on the cusp of acquiring the world's most dangerous weapons.
Thomas Erdbrink in Tehran, the Trump administration is betting these renewed sanctions will pressure Tehran to abandon its nuclear enrichment efforts and end its military and economic support for Shiite militant allies across the Middle East. I mean, that is quite a tall order. Talk a little bit about your sense of the government reaction to that strategy.
Well, of course, we have to highlight that according to the International Atomic Energy Agency, the UN nuclear watchdog, Iran has not transgressed anything of this nuclear agreement. They have stuck to the agreement. They did what they needed to do according to the agreement. There have been monitors here on the ground. There have been 7 reports by the IAEA, the UN nuclear watchdog. And so the Iranians would say, look, we stuck to the agreement, and Trump unilaterally withdrew from it because he didn't like the agreement. So the government has been defiant. They've been trying to get support from Europe, and they have gotten support from Europe, because in the current geopolitical climate, Europe is further and further alienated from the U.S. administration. Of course, I'm sure you have discussed on this program the trade war with China, but also with the Europeans, the back and forth between Trump and European leaders. So the Europeans very much feel that the nuclear deal is an essential part of their security. Now, why do they feel that? Well, look at Syria. Syria in the past 7 years has turned into a hellhole. Millions of refugees have come to Europe. That has led to an enormous rise of populist right-wing parties in Europe who all oppose the idea of the European Union. If Iran were to become unstable, a country of 80 million people that are very used to migrating, everyone here has an uncle or an aunt or a brother or a sister living somewhere in Europe, then a lot of Iranians will pack their bags and leave for Europe, which will lead to lots of problems in Europe. So for the Europeans, the nuclear deal is an essential part of their political security, and Trump is going directly against it, has people in his administration that very regularly speak of regime change in Iran, something that the Europeans find very fearful. So the Iranians have managed to sort of get the Europeans in this front on their side. But yeah, in reality, America is the biggest economy in the world. I mean, after China, of course, but it's a very influential economy when it comes to Europe. And the European Union can't do all at once. But yesterday they said, we oppose the sanctions and we have taken measures to protect European companies.
We're talking about the way forward in Iran with Thomas Erdbrink of the New York Times. Join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. And Amir is calling from Madison, Wisconsin. Amir, welcome to the conversation.
Hi, Eric. Thank you for having me. I'm an Iranian-American. I was teaching in Iran a few years ago, during Obama's administration. And I was really happy to see that as an American, that Iranians liked Americans on the street, that there was such a willingness to embrace me as someone from America. And I'm afraid that that might be lost with some of the moves that this administration is making. And my family personally was very much hurt by the revolution. The clergy has done a lot of bad things to my family, but we don't want to see another revolution. We want the country to evolve, because we're just afraid that, you know, everyday people there are just going to get hurt, and the Iranian government is going to be able to ride out a lot of things that Trump is going to throw his way, but the everyday people are the ones that are suffering, whose money is devaluing by the day, and who won't be able to get their hands on medication and things of that nature. Thank you. I'll take my question off there.
Amir, thanks for your call. And Thomas, briefly, I mean, he's talking about you know, his family that's still in Iran is have lost a lot of their wealth and were hurt by the revolution and by the sanctions.
And Amir is also saying that he wants Iran to evolve. And of course, it's very difficult for a country of 80 million people to evolve naturally if on one hand you are ruled by leaders with an ideology, and on the other hand, you're constantly facing opposition from the most powerful country in the world, the United States. One thing that Amir highlighted very, very clearly is how much Iranians actually like and welcome Americans. And that is really something that often gets lost in the conversation. That's absolutely right.
Lots more to come. We're discussing financial sanctions on Iran and the way forward. Listeners, do you have questions for our reporter in Tehran? What is life like in the country now? How do sanctions impact everyday life? I'm Eric Westervelt. You're listening to On Point.
Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Chances are you're confident when it comes to your work, your hobbies, and your life. Rocket Mortgage gives you that same level of confidence when it comes to buying a home or refinancing your existing home loan. Rocket Mortgage is simple, allowing you to fully understand all the details and be confident you're getting the right mortgage for you. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states. NMLS ConsumerAccess.org, number 3030.
Hey, Asma.
Hey, Scott.
Another crazy week. We've got North Korea.
Yep, we got Russia.
Midterms.
And, of course, President Trump. And what happens whenever there is crazy news that erupts? We pop into the studio and break it down to make sense.
So if you see a headline,
we've discussed it.
It's the NPR Politics Podcast.
You're listening to On Point. I'm Eric Westervelt. We're talking about the financial sanctions on Iran and the way forward for U.S. policy. You can join the conversation. Do you think this is a good idea right now? What exactly do you think the Trump administration is trying to achieve strategically? Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. We have with us Thomas Erdbrink, the Tehran bureau chief for the New York Times. And joining me from Denver, Colorado, is Ruel Marc Gerek, senior fellow with the Foundation for Defense of Democracies. He's the former director of the Middle East Initiative at the Project for the New American Century and a former Middle East specialist at the CIA's Directorate of Operations. He did a story for the Weekly Standard recently where he is a contributing editor, headlined "The Preeminent Challenge for President Trump and His Foreign Policy Team, Cracking the Islamic Republic is Job One." You can link to it at our website, onpointradio.org. And thanks for joining us, Ruel.
My pleasure, Eric.
Also joining the conversation now from Washington, D.C. is Jarrett Blunk, a senior fellow in the Geoeconomics and Strategy Program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. He's the former State Department coordinator for Iran nuclear implementation at the State Department under President Obama, where he was responsible for the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action on Iran's nuclear program. Jarrett, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Jared, I want to start with you. I mean, do you think the Trump administration has a sensible, coherent strategy for dealing with Iran's nuclear program?
No, I think quite clearly they do not. The nuclear program was in a box for 10 years, and the Trump administration decided to pull out of the deal without sufficient consultation with the Europeans, without sufficient consultation with the Chinese, and to be blunt, see what happens.
Now, I want to ask you, Reuel Marc Gerecht, do you see a coherent strategy here where Jarrett does not?
Oh, I say it's tolerably coherent. I mean, if the objective of the Trump administration is to renegotiate a nuclear deal, then I suspect then, it's got a few issues, a few problems. But if the objective of the Trump administration is to put enormous pressure on the Islamic Republic to remove it from any type of an atomic clock and to just adopt a containment, or at least part of a containment strategy, with the ultimate aim, as it was with the Soviet Union, to be the regime change, the collapse of the regime, then I think it does make sense. Now, there is a contradiction. The president, Michael Pompeo, the Secretary of State, John Bolton, National Security Advisor, keep telling us that they're not trying to actually adopt a regime change policy, that their objective is to renegotiate the nuclear deal and to change Iran's behavior. I would say, though, you know, after a time, policy change does mean regime change. What they are essentially asking is for the Islamic Republic, for the clerical regime, to change its spots.
Reuel Marc Gerecht, you've called for regime change openly. Let's define our terms. Are you talking about military intervention on the ground?
No, of course not.
Well, what are you referring to when you talk about regime change in your Weekly Standard piece?
It's to essentially to support the protest movements, the internal protests, which have been gaining speed actually for decades, inside of the Islamic Republic, to explicitly say that the American objective is to see the end of theocracy in Iran and to support the growth of democracy. I mean, people tend to scoff at that idea now, and democracy promotion has gotten a bad name. That was true for President Obama and is true for President Trump. But the real truth is there's been an internal quest for greater popular representation in Iran for over 100 years. That quest is as old as is in some European countries. And it's far time that we recognize that, and we adjusted our policy accordingly. And I think the only sensible thing for the United States to do is to support that caldera of popular anger that is quite vivid inside of Iran against theocracy.
Well, Marc Gerecht, but given the policy interventionist debacle in Iraq, intervention, quite rightly to many, has a bad name and doesn't seem like a realistic path.
Well, again, you're talking about apples and oranges. I mean, we can have a separate argument, if you will, whether eliminating Saddam Hussein was a good idea. I think it was, but that is not what is being discussed, as far as I can tell, inside of the Trump administration. I mean, the Trump administration has so far been unwilling to adopt, say, the type of approach the United States had against the Soviet Union. That is, we support efforts to hurt we supported efforts to hurt the Soviets in their wars of expansion. We aren't doing that against the Islamic Republic. The Trump administration has been highly resistant to giving any type of military aid, serious effort, for example, to push back against the Iranians in Syria. We don't seem to be on the verge of adopting a containment strategy. So if you're not willing to push back against the Iranians on the periphery, the United States certainly isn't going to be willing to engage in any type of direct military occupation of the Islamic Republic. That just simply isn't the cards. What is in the cards, and they are developing reasonably coherently, is an economic approach to just tightening the screws on the Islamic Republic.
Thomas Erdbrink of the New York Times in Tehran, Reuel Marc Gerecht talks about a cauldron of protests, and you've been reporting on that, and you've got a PBS Frontline documentary on next week about life inside Iran. Talk a little bit about what you think is behind that dissatisfaction. It's a range of grievances, not necessarily one thing, correct? Thomas Erdbrink, are you still with us from Tehran?
I am, sorry. So that is absolutely correct. I think these grievances are very important and very real, but we must not take them out of context. The grievances are first and foremost about the economy, would people's pockets be filled with money here, something the nuclear deal had promised to do, if the United States, even under Obama, didn't freeze all bank transactions between European banks and Iran, then there would be much less discontent here in this country. But that hasn't happened. At the same time, as I mentioned before, we must never forget that the economy here is ruled by ideology, that therefore there are a lot of bad economic decisions taken, and there's been a lot of corruption. All these things together have made people really upset. Then on top of that, there are rules here in the Islamic Republic that decide what kind of clothes you must wear. For instance, the compulsory Islamic headscarf, or rules that decide that men aren't allowed to wear shorts, stuff like this. So also these personal rules make life harder for the people. They aren't implemented as much as before. People have more space. The society doesn't support these rules anymore, leaving it only up to the security forces to sort of make sure people dress the way Iran's leaders want them to. But yes, people are also longing for more freedom and more personal freedom. But first and foremost, this is the economy.
We're talking about Iran and the way forward. Joining us now is Doug from Los Alamos. Welcome to the conversation, Doug.
Thank you. I'm a nuclear physicist. I'm retired from Los Alamos National Laboratory in the IAEA. The JCPOA, that is the Iran nuclear deal, is far better than I expected, and it blocks every possible avenue, if followed by all parties, to fabricate a nuclear explosive. I know and have helped teach some of the inspectors who go and inspect Iran. It is not what Trump says. It was an excellent deal that did what it said. Yes, it doesn't deal with some of the other issues. But if it had, you've never gotten a deal. You can't put everything together. But thank you for taking my call.
Doug, thanks for your comments. It didn't deal with everything, including Iran's ballistic missile program. Jarrett Blanc, could you weigh in on that?
Well, I think Doug is exactly right, and especially his last point. Anybody who says that the diplomatic solution was insufficient because it didn't address every point of friction between the United States and Iran is really saying, let's not try diplomacy, because you can't find a case of two countries with as many adversarial positions as the United States and Iran that have dealt with them all in one go. As Doug said, we dealt with the nuclear program, we dealt with it very well, and we created a platform that we could have used to start to address other points of disagreement diplomatically. If I could also just quickly respond to Ruel, because I think he's actually done a very nice job of explaining the incoherence of the administration's policy. They say they don't want regime change, but then they lay out demands of Iran that amount to regime change. I think that that internal disagreement comes from the fact that President Trump is unwilling to do the things, what Ruel describes, I think, bloodlessly as regional pushback, but would in fact not be bloodless, that would be required for that kind of very aggressive policy. Also, there's not a coherent economic approach at this stage, just because we don't have coherence with our allies and with Iran's major trading partners.
And Jarrett Blanc, Trump has talked tough on North Korea, calling him Rocket Man, and then held an historic meeting with that country's dictator that so far looks like some semblance of progress on denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula. Do you think there's any chance this could lead to some kind of grand bargain negotiation with Tehran?
Well, I actually would disagree that the Singapore meeting has resulted in progress toward denuclearization. It's resulted in a reiteration of some fairly weak statements from 10 and 15 years ago from the North Koreans. Until we see measurable steps like the JCPOA, I'll reserve judgment. I would love, in a certain respect, to have that kind of outcome with Iran, where we just lower the tension by allowing President Trump to claim victory. I think it's much less likely because the politics inside Tehran regarding the United States are much more poisonous. And frankly, the politics in Washington regarding Iran are much more poisonous. I don't think President Trump could get away with the wildly exaggerated claims that he's made about North Korea in an Iran context.
And Ruel, Mark Grecht, to Jarrett's point that any regime change would not be bloodless at all.
Well, of course not. I mean, if you're going to engage in a containment strategy, the Cold War, the containment approach the United States adopted to the Soviet Union was hardly bloodless. It was successful. So if the administration is going to engage in regional containment, we've seen no signs yet that it is, then pushing back against the Islamic Republic, which is a connoisseur of using hard power, machtpolitik, would in fact be bloody. There's no doubt about that. But the administration isn't going there. Now, it does have a reasonably coherent economic approach towards the Islamic Republic. It is demonstrating something that the Obama administration could never really embrace terribly enthusiastically, and that is the power of the U.S. dollar and the power of the American economy as a coercive tool. The Obama administration didn't really want to go there because I think ultimately they had this conception of the Islamic Republic which proved false, and that is that Rouhani was a moderate, a pragmatist, and that somehow the nuclear deal would lead to some type of Thermidor. You know, there have been a group of quite thoughtful scholars trying to spot Thermidor in Iran for over 30 years in France, and God bless their efforts. It just hasn't proven true. And Rouhani is far, far from being a moderate. So the administration has one part of a very sensible approach, and it's perhaps the most important part, and that is trying to adopt an approach that will squeeze the hard currency out of this regime and make it extremely difficult for it to fund its nefarious activities and advance the nuclear weapons program, which they haven't given up. The part that doesn't make a lot of sense is that they aren't going to try to adopt a containment strategy, which I would argue would be sort of 101 in hard politics if the United States wanted to bring maximum pressure against the Islamic Republic, and we don't. What we want to bring is maximum economic pressure, and they're going to try to do the best that they can, given those constraints.
It's On Point. We're talking Iran sanctions and the way ahead, and Sammy is calling from Detroit. Sammy, welcome to the program.
Thanks for taking my call. This is actually first time calling in, and I enjoyed the conversation about the Iranian program. First of all, like, I've been living here so long, over 20 years, and as far as I've seen, like, our government won't go nowhere. Always we go around. My point is, we cannot change a whole country just because of the regime. If you look about what's going on since 90 till 2010, I don't want to say 2018, because we're 8 years back. If you think about Iranian, the government, they're not allowed to do this, not allowed to do that, no democracy. We're wrong, because as American, Arab American, I went to Iran a couple times. Yeah. And so far here, I choose this country for one reason, for freedom of speech, for freedom of religion. If you go there, you're seeing your own things, what's going on. People, are, of course, are they are tired about a lot of stuff, but from us to go over them because their nuclear program, they will be around for us.
All right, Sammy, thank you for your point. We appreciate it. I think we should not take action in the region. And I guess Thomas Erdbrink, The New York Times, Sammy says it's not necessarily America's place to meddle. And overall, there still have been protests, as you've reported, in parts of the country, but they were smaller than the 2009 anti-government demonstrations when it's estimated that millions took to the street. Yes?
Yes, that's absolutely true. In 2009, as a reaction to the re-election of then-President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, over 3 million took to the streets in Tehran alone in massive protests that all in all lasted 6 months. Now, we've seen protests here also, unprecedented protests, I must say, in January, when in over 80 cities people took to the streets, and we've seen protests throughout the last months, often isolated protest, and again a pickup of more broader protest last week, when in four or five cities people took to the streets in numbers ranging in the hundreds. The thing is that these people who go on the streets, they they don't know what they're actually protesting for. They really know what they're protesting against. They're protesting against their leaders. They're protesting against the bad economy. They're protesting against lack of personal freedoms. But the fact that their numbers aren't big enough to make a real impact shows that the middle class here isn't really ready to join this protest at this point, because they don't know why what they should go on the streets, for what reason, what will they achieve.
The middle class not yet ready to join the protests across Iran. We're discussing the Trump administration's actions on sanctions on Tehran. You can join the conversation. Do you think Iran presents a real threat to America? Do you think the Trump administration is trying to produce regime change? I'm Eric Westervelt. You're listening to On Point.
This message comes from NPR's sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
Did cutting taxes actually grow the economy?
And what makes DJ Khaled the king of pop music?
The Indicator, a daily podcast where we tackle the big economic questions.
You're listening to On Point. I'm Eric Westervelt. We're talking about U.S. sanctions on Iran, automobiles, on gold, on steel. You can join the conversation. Do you think the goal of forging ahead solo with these sanctions is worth breaking with our European allies? Do you think they'll follow our lead or continue to do business with Iran? Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook, On Point Radio. We have with us Thomas Erdbrink, the Tehran bureau chief for the New York Times, who joins us from Tehran. Ruel Marc Gerecht, a senior fellow with the Foundation for Defense of Democracies. And Jarrett Blunt, senior fellow in the Geoeconomics and Strategy Program at the Carnegie Endowment for Peace. Jarrett Blunt, excuse me on your pronunciation there. Let's go a little bit to some tape of the Iranian leader. In an interview on Iranian state television yesterday, President Hassan Rouhani spoke defiantly about the new sanctions leveled on his country. Rouhani said he'll only speak to President Trump or members of his administration if sanctions are lifted.
What he is doing is an action against the Iranian nation and Iran's national interests. So if there is trust, Iran has always welcomed negotiations. The negotiation does not make sense with sanctions.
Jarrett Blunk, Iran says we won't talk with an economic gun to our head.
I think that President Rouhani is trying to walk a very fine line here. He probably doesn't want to rule out negotiations in the future entirely, especially having seen what President Trump has been willing to give away in North Korea. And he wants to maintain the high ground with the Europeans of saying, look, we're the ones who are trying a diplomatic solution, allowing one of the advantages that Iran has received from President Trump's policy, which is the relative isolation of the United States vis-a-vis Iran and vis-a-vis Europe.
And Ruel Marc Gerecht, I'm wondering your take. Jarrett says he's walking a fine line, and so are our European allies who want to maintain good relations with the Trump administration, but also had business interests there. Talk a little bit about the EU reaction.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's fair to say the Europeans have been upset and cranky. I think it's also clear that they're simply not going to mount a substantial resistance to the Trump administration's policy. I think that has been made crystal clear by the major European companies. You're going to see the continuation of some small-scale business. You've always had that. Particularly in Germany, there are going to be small, mid-sized companies that have relatively little exposure to the United States and can work out some means for making a profit, not a big one, inside of the Islamic Republic. But so far as the big industries, the ones that the Islamic Republic, the clerical regime wanted, that's not going to happen. And they're not going to use the European Central Bank or the European Investment Bank as effective institutions to engage in commercial banking. The odds of that, I think, are extremely poor, regardless of whatever legislation comes out of the EU national governments. I just don't think there's a much will for it. Now, it is interesting on what Rouhani and the Islamic Republic might do in response to Trump. The intelligent thing for them to do is to see if they can bait Trump, to get him into the same type of meeting that they got, the Kim Jong-un got him into in Singapore. I don't know if that can happen. That would be the intelligent approach. I don't know if the Islamic Republic is capable, the clerical regime is capable of doing that. Khamenei would have to eat a skyscraper's worth of crow to go there, but that would be the scenario that would be intriguing because it might split the administration. Mm. President Trump may not have the views of Secretary Pompeo or John Bolton on the Islamic Republic. We just don't know that for sure. So that would be the intelligent thing to do, the clever thing to do, but I'm not sure the clerical regime is that clever.
If I may, I think Ruel is missing the key point on the economics here, which is that it's true that Europe is probably at best able to sustain fairly modest economic activity with Iran. But China reduced its oil imports under President Obama by more than 20% in 2 years. So when Raul says that the Obama administration never came to embrace U.S. economic power, we managed to cut Iranian oil sales much more than the Trump administration at this point is even realistically targeting, whether or not they could hit that target. So this is where I say again, there is not a coherent economic policy here. There will be less economic pressure on Iran under this policy than the Obama administration managed to build. And so then the question comes to the point that Thomas and Sammy made. Is the regime more fragile today than it was in 2012, 13, 14? If not, I think it's pretty clear that it's going to be subjected to less economic pressure.
Thomas, to you, to that question that Jarrett raises, do you think fundamentally the regime is in a more precarious shape now today than it was earlier?
I think that's very hard to measure. I mean, I really enjoy listening to Jarrett and to Ruel, but they are both in the United States, and they view the world through power, basically through the U.S.'s raw power. And Ruel particularly is pleased to hear that there will be no European companies coming to Iran. He's pleased to hear that there will be no investment made. And I was recently here at the KLM office, the national airline of the Netherlands, that closed its office because of the sanctions. And there were 12 women sitting there, and they were all crying because they'd lost their jobs. And these were women, some of them were divorced. They had to take care of their children. They didn't know what to do. I don't know if this makes the regime stronger, or I don't know if this makes the regime weaker. But what I do know is that these women had a chance, and a lot of people like them, to a better life under this nuclear agreement because foreign investment was coming. And this is what America is taking away from them. And this is why I hope that everybody will watch my two films on PBS Frontline on Monday and Tuesday, because that's where you get to meet the real Iranians. That's where we will go beyond the politics. That's where we will stop only talking about the regime that plays a very, very bad role, admitted. But we also get to meet Iranian people and see what they have to say. Mm. I think this is what's always missing in discussion in Washington.
Thomas's documentary, Our Man in Tehran, will air in two parts, August 13th and 14th. We're talking about Iran, sanctions, the way forward. Dina is calling from Boston. Dina, welcome to the conversation.
Thank you for taking my call. I have a somewhat different point of view. I am Israeli-American. I moved to Israel. I was born in the United States. I moved to Israel 2005. And once living there, I found a completely different point of view and different from all my American family who also view things from an American point of view. The fact is that when Obama took office, he went to the Middle East and apologized for America's actions everywhere, basically. And what people don't take into account and don't discuss is that the regime in Iran are calling for death to America, death to Israel. They are nuts. They're crazy, psychotic, Islamic fanatics.
All right, we've got your point. It's an aggressive presence throughout the Middle East. Jarrett Blunk, to Dina's point, that essentially when you look at the Tehran regime's support for Hezbollah in Lebanon, for Islamic Jihad in Gaza, to the arguably atrociously brutal regime in Syria, the Assad regime. We're talking about a regime that does spread its hard line around the Middle East.
Well, you know, my first response to Dina would be that days after the JCPOA was fully implemented in January 2016, the chief of the Israeli army staff spoke at the Herzliya Security Conference and said, effectively, Iran is no longer an existential threat to Israel as a result of the JCPOA. Mm-hmm. It's a threat, but not an existential threat. And that's one of the things that's been thrown overboard by the Trump administration's, I think, chaotic policymaking. I think pulling the lens back a little bit further and responding both to Dina and to Ruel, who have painted the Iranian threat in these global catastrophic terms. We should think of it as the USSR. It has to be contained and confronted in that way. I just think that that makes no sense. It makes even less sense, quite frankly, than the failed Iraq analogy. Iran is a regional power. They do some things that we don't like. We've got all kinds of tools to address those things. Imagining that they pose a threat to us the way that USSR posed a threat and that we need to respond accordingly is the road to incredibly poor policymaking, like recent reporting that we're funding al-Qaeda in Yemen in order to confront Iran there.
Ruel, I'll let you respond. Are you exaggerating by painting this as a global catastrophic threat?
I'm not painting it as a global catastrophic threat. I'm just using a simple Soviet parallel of using a containment strategy. You can use containment strategies against regional threats as well as global threats. The Islamic Republic is a nefarious force. It's been a nefarious force in the region since the Islamic Revolution. It's an explicitly anti-American force. I have to give it compliment. I mean, for example, it's done something that no Islamic State has been able to do in the modern era. That is, it's been able to raise a foreign legion, a Shiite foreign legion, and deploy it into battle, and that foreign legion is by no means going away. Mm. It is in America's interests to change the regime in the Islamic Republic. Now, I would argue that everybody is in favor of regime change, including Thomas in Tehran. It's the question is how you do it. Do you think that Thermidor is going to arrive, that there is going to be this slow evolution and that the Islamic Republic is just going on its own, going to evolve in something less threatening? I don't think so. I mean, I think the process of reform that was real in the Islamic Republic and arrived somewhat unexpectedly in 1997 with the election of Mohammad Khatami got stuffed. And that what we actually see in Tehran is actually amongst the ruling elites sort of is coarsening. It's become much more aggressive. We can argue about the reasons why it's become much more aggressive. And I think just in general, it's in America's interest to push back on that. Now, we have a big problem because the Obama administration and the Trump administration are both in favor of policy of retrenchment, that they are not in favor of American hegemony. They don't believe the world is in a better place if America stands out there and tries to protect the liberal world order. I think it is, and I think it is. It behooves us to take the Islamic Republic seriously. It behooves us to comment what the woman said on the phone. The Islamic Republic is the most virulent anti-Semitic regime out there. I mean, the supreme leader, Ali Khamenei, has Jews on the brain. He's obsessed with the issue. I would suggest that that is indicative of a larger problem for the Islamic Republic. It is indicative of the malign nature of the clerical regime, and we should take it seriously, and we should do what we can to oppose it. And I don't think engagement has worked. I don't think engagement will work. And I think you need to take a bigger view.
Points well taken. Let's get some more callers involved in the conversation. Ian is calling from Saranac, New York. Ian, welcome to On Point. Ian, are you with us? All right. Well, let's go to Ali from Boston, Massachusetts. Ali, welcome to the conversation.
Thank you for taking my call. I just wanted to point out something that your guest may be aware, there is a Voice of America service, the Persian service, that's being broadcast to Iran. They have different programs. Some of the programs allow callers from Iran, from cross-section of the country, from different regions of the country, to call, whether through their computers or any means, or even send messages via email or Twitter that they can bypass through filtering and cannot be tracked. And I truly wish that the American government would increase the budget of this service.
Okay, Voice of America has a service that reaches Iranians. Thomas, thank you for your call. Thomas Erdbrink in Tehran. I want to ask you, talk a little bit about what restrictions ordinary Iranians face when they're trying to access the outside world and get information, whether it's Voice of America or going on social media.
Well, actually, Iranians have, to, of course, to deal with their government's firewall that, just like in China, blocks millions of websites. But at the same time, technology has gone so fast that every Iranian on their phone or on their computer has a VPN, something that you can use to sort of bypass the firewall. And then when they come home, they can turn on their illegal satellite receiver, which, if I just look out of my window here, I can already see like dozens hanging from the apartment building across from my window. So they're illegal but very widely tolerated. And then they can view over 150 Persian language channels operating from abroad. So the monopoly of the state TV that of course disseminates the views of the leaders has long ago been really undermined by such channels.
Secretary of State Mike Pompeo reiterated and has repeatedly the administration's demand that Iran stop intervening militarily across the Middle East. He said, look, you can't, you know, arm people in Iraq and Syria and support Lebanese Hezbollah and other militant groups. I'm curious, Thomas, what do ordinary Iranians think of the country's economic military support for other militant groups and regimes, given their economic straits?
Well, they very much dislike it. They have the feeling that all their money is going to Hezbollah and to groups in Iraq. And at the same time, they see their own currency devaluating by the day. So during those protests, you hear people also chanting against the presence in Syria and against the presence in Iraq. At the same time, of course, Iran's leaders would say, look, the ISIS was a real problem in the region. At some point, they were 40 kilometers from Iran's borders. They would say we had to intervene in order to prevent them from destabilizing our country. Iran is one of the most calmest countries in the Middle East. So, but people don't really see it that way. They feel that Iran's time of military adventures in the Middle East is over. And that is something that also Rouhani yesterday spoke about. He said now there's peace in the region, so we can definitely think about withdrawing our troops.
Thanks to everyone who called in. Thomas Erdbrink, Tehran bureau chief for the New York Times, thank you for your time. We really appreciate it.
Thank you.
His Frontline documentary airs this Monday and Tuesday. Ruel Markarek, senior fellow with the Foundation for Defense of Democracies, thank you for coming in.
Thank you much.
And Jared Blunk, senior fellow in the Geoeconomics and Strategy Program of the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, thank you for your insights.
Thank you, Eric.
You can continue the conversation. Get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. I'm Eric Westervelt. You're listening to On Point.